Welcome, folks, to the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Saturday, February 5th edition. And we're here today with myself, David Johnson, and Jason Kozlowski. Tom Thomas, unfortunately, is a little under the weather, both figuratively and literally. And Bob Plesney's down in Memphis right now. So first, we'll hear some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners at WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour, a democratic union. The BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. Also, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the community radio in East Central Illinois.
Dave? Okay, also, I think we got another one from the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way.
Oh, that was the first one I read.
Oh, you read that? Okay, I'm sorry. I was fumbling here a little bit. Excuse a little. We're just a little bit disorganized here this morning with all the snow, the bad weather conditions, Tom and Bob not being here and everything. But we still promise you a really interesting show today. We're going to be talking a little bit about, well, first of all, February is Black History Month. So starting this show and throughout the month of February, we're going to be talking about important African-American labor figures. And also later in the show, we're going to be talking a little bit about Howard Zinn, the famous people's historian who died about a year ago, back in January 27th, 2010. So anyway, I guess we're going to be going to some news stories here, and then we'll get into the more meat of the show, if you will. Jason?
Okay. This one's brought to us by way of Labor Notes, a story by Howard Ryan. A billionaire gang headed by Bill Gates and Eli Broad wants to capture the billions spent on America's public schools and convert them into a corporate-owned test score factory. But their plan has faced teacher resistance, and nowhere more than in Chicago, where a feisty new leadership is heading the Chicago Teachers Union. Billionaires went toe-to-toe with the CTU and Illinois' 200,000 unionized teachers, pushing a state law that would have maximized the firing of teachers at will and gutted the very organizations best equipped to fight for good public schools, the teachers' unions. The Illinois bill, called the Performance Counts Act, never got beyond committee in the legislature. After the CTU and statewide teachers' unions worked together to mobilize teachers and community supporters to squash it. Last October, journalists had noticed that candidates for the Illinois legislative seats were receiving unusually large checks, one as high as $175,000 to a single state legislative candidate. Another reporter had observed that, quote, the national education reform has quietly dumped more than $600,000 into key Illinois legislative races, end quote. That group is Stand for Children, a formerly grassroots organization that is now an enormously well-funded organization based in Portland, Oregon, with affiliates in seven states. SFC's largest single funder is Bill Gates. And the aspects of the bill that were being pushed are several anti-union provisions, such as closely linking teachers' performance evaluations to standardized test scores, the ability to fire a tenured teacher or return his or her to probationary status after a single unsatisfactory evaluation, to prohibit unions from bargaining over contracting out, layoffs, school closures, class size, and class staffing, the length of day or a work day, and the ability to strip teachers' right to strike and punish unlawful strikes with union decertification. David?
Yes, Bill Gates bankrolled that film Waiting for Superman. It's a horribly anti-union, pro-privatization film. And make no mistake, folks, this whole thing about you know, supposedly concern about children education and quality in education, all this is just all it is a smokescreen to try to privatize our public schools. Make no mistake about that. Charter schools have an extremely poor performance rate. I mean, it only makes sense because charter schools are private schools, and part of the function or the main function of a private corporate entity is to make a profit. So, you know, the thing is that they're going to have the same maintenance costs and everything else as a regular public school, but they're going to want to make at least, 10-20% profit on top of that. And unfortunately, that happens. School employees suffer. Students suffer. And the whole community suffers. Just had to put a little... that little 2 cents worth in there. This is an issue that we're going to be seeing more and more of, I think, here in this year in particular.
Absolutely.
Okay, the story is from China. Hong Kong's Information Center for Human Rights and Democracy reported that last Sunday, riot police in China's Wuzhou City in the southwestern Guangxi province opened fire on 100 construction workers demonstrating over unpaid wages. The Information Center said a local hospital officer had confirmed that about 20 people were sent to the hospital, including 5 who sustained gunshot wounds. No deaths were reported. Chinese websites circulated photos showing workers confronting the riot police before the shooting. Workers from a residential construction site in Kangwu County had headed to Wuzhou City and staged a demonstration in front of the municipal government building. According to Japan's Kyoto News Agency, the construction contractor owed workers 1 million yuan, or $150,000 U.S. dollars in wages, but had fled to the adjacent Guangdong province after the construction was finished. As the workers marched on, about 1,000 onlookers joined them. Instead of justice from the government, however, more than 100 heavily armed riot police met them. As the crowd continued to grow, the police fired warning shots in the sky and then opened fire on the workers with rubber bullets, tear gas, and eventually live ammunition. Apart from those who were shot, scores were injured during the resulting panic, and the police arrested several protesters. It was the second major reported incidence in 4 days in which the Chinese Communist Party regime responded to labor unrest with brutal police state repression. On January 19th, around 1,000 riot police clashed with garment workers in Wuhan protesting over the corrupt privatization of their factory. There we go again, more privatization. The vicious response of the Chinese authorities to the protests is rooted in the fear that rising prices of food, basic necessities, and housing, which have recently or has seriously eroded the living standards of the working people, could trigger a broader anti-government movement. There's also been media silence over the uprising in Tunisia and Egypt due to concerns that Chinese workers and rural poor could follow the good example.
It's interesting because, for listeners out there, and understandably people as consumers and workers are under considerable pressures from outsourcing, especially to places like China, but all those particular buzzwords in the article about privatization, outsourcing, fear of inflation, workers who are going without pay, the repression that goes on. I mean, look at the commonalities with different degrees of severity, but look at the commonalities, people, to all these different things that we experience here. Just something to keep in mind when people want to talk about those Chinese or people taking their jobs, that they're facing so many of the same pressures under a lot worse circumstances, especially with poverty. We aren't here.
Oh, indeed. The problem isn't Chinese workers or Mexican workers or Korean workers where a lot of American jobs have went. It's with the corporations that have moved them there. And I am going to add our own government under both Republican and Democratic administrations that has encouraged this and have actually given tax incentives to these companies to move. I mean, it's disgusting. I mean, it really is. And yes, I mean, these workers need to live too, but the course, the whole problem is that this whole regime of international global trade, as opposed to import substitution and self-sufficiency models of economic development, which every country should have as a basis of their economy. Not to say I'm against international trade. I like Costa Rican coffee and German beer, just like a lot of other people do. But I mean, you got to start with the basics, and they've got the whole thing upside down and totally working against the best interests of working people worldwide.
No doubt about it. Another story here from Illinois. Two local grain bin companies are being fined thousands of dollars by the U.S. Department of Labor. All of the violations are related to accidental deaths that happened at the companies in Mount Carroll and Geneseo. Two teens were killed at Hasbeck in Mount Carroll in July, according to the report. 14-year-old Wyatt Whitebread and 19-year-old Alex Packus were killed after becoming entrapped in corn 30 feet deep. The teens and two others were walking on the corn to make it flow while machinery used for evacuating the grain was running. 24 OSHA citations were issued. Investigators say the company did not provide body harnesses and lifelines to prevent engulfment. The report says workers were not trained on the hazards of moving grain. Hasbeck is also charged with violating child labor law standards. OSHA says the company employed two 14-year-olds and a 15-year-old in a hazardous occupation. Investigators also say two of the teens had to climb 48 feet to enter a grain bin, and another teen operated a power-driven hoisting device. Hatchback total fines were more than $500,000. The other deadly grain bin accident happened in Geneseo in the Hillsdale Elevator Company. 49-year-old Raymond Nolan was killed while sweeping the inside of a grain bin. Investigators say grain that was built up on the wall fell on Nolan, suffocating him. OSHA has fined Hillsdale Elevator $729,000. The company also received 22 citations. According to the investigators, the company directed workers to enter bins, silos, or tanks where a buildup of grain on the sides could fall and bury them. The company is also charged with failing to take measures to prevent mechanical equipment in the bin from endangering employees. Both companies have 15 days to comply and request an informal conference with OSHA's area director.
David. You know, another common problem we seem to be having, more and more job site injuries, you know, and it's not from alcohol or drugs. It's from basically these companies, skimping on safety and forcing workers to do work in unsafe conditions, all in order so they can make more profits.
And these are kids.
Yes, and these are kids on this. I mean, this is stuff you used to read about, like that happened in the 1920s and 1890s, you know, and here it is, the 21st century. Of course, as a lot of people know, there's been a lot of interesting things happening here in the Middle East lately, and in Egypt. This is from our friend Harry Kelber in New York City. He writes, "This generation of dissidents, most of whom have lived their entire lives under the three-decade rule of President Hosni Mubarak, have rebelled against a dictatorship that tolerates high unemployment and suppresses free speech. President Mubarak ordered a crackdown of the rebellion while promising reforms in a television address, ignoring U.S. President Barack Obama, who urged Mubarak to exercise caution and restraint. The massive protest is said to have been triggered by a 2008 strike of textile workers in the Nile Delta that aroused an expanding protest movement against political oppression and economic hardship. The traditional working class from all corners of the country have continued to inspire protests ever since occupying the streets outside of Parliament for weeks on end. But what started on January 25th was a set of specific demands, the resignation of the Interior Minister, the end of the emergency law, and the imposition of a two-year term limit on the presidency. The demands have coalesced into something far more radical and brought countless more people whose latent hostility to the Mubarak regime had never before translated into concrete action, into confrontation with the state." And again, the labor movement's in the forefront, in the lead of this social rebellion. What's happening? Where's our labor leadership in this country? We need a rebellion like what's happening in Tunisia and Egypt in this country, but we don't seem to see it from Richard Trumka or any of these other leaders, and it's time they start doing something or step out of the way for new leadership.
No doubt about it. And, you know, and I thought about that, David, when we a few weeks ago had covered the issue of the workers in Metropolis who were locked out, the steel workers. And my God, especially given all the different safety concerns about this, how is this not a touchstone issue for the AFL-CIO? I mean, you are looking at the possibility of a serious cataclysm as a result of people who are not qualified to handle this these hazardous materials, who are handling them. And where is the AFL-CIO on this of all things, for goodness sakes? I mean, there are plenty of different things, but talk about an issue right in our backyard that the AFL-CIO should be all over, and they are just taking a powder on it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, unfortunately, this whole society right now is corrupt, and I'm sorry to say it includes most of the labor leadership. This is why I think it's important that we have something similar happen in this country, what's been going on in Tunisia and Egypt, because our society is rotten to the core, including our labor leadership. They need to get out of the way and make room for new leadership from the ranks that are actually going to do what needs to be done in the best interest of the membership and the working class in general, because we can't continue down this path any longer. It's getting worse and worse, and I don't see any action on the part of the labor leadership.
Yeah, acquiescence is complicity in all this stuff.
Indeed. Oh. Okay, John, by the way, we have John Fitton in the studio with us. He's a member of the Laborers International Union here in Champaign-Urbana, and John's been on the show before, and he wanted to come in and talk about an article, actually, out of the, I believe it's the News Gazette, that he wants to kind of share with us and give a little commentary on.
Yeah, it's about unemployment. Seen yesterday, they was expecting 145,000 people put on jobs, and they only come up with about 35,000. But this is 10 years now that the construction industry is at its low. 10 years. And it started with the housing collapse in 2006. So they've been at it now 4 or 5 years, and it don't look much better. So the manufacturing people's twice as much as construction as workers. And last year, the construction spending fell to $814 billion last year, the Commerce Department reported. That sounds awful high because it's out of that $27 billion, I don't even think they put that money out into the system. That's the lowest level in a decade and nearly half of what some economists consider to be unhealthy. 6 months ago, Obama's people said that they weren't putting people back to work because it caused the inflation and scared to death about the interest rates going up. Well, whoop-dee-doo. 2009, my income fell to one-fourth of what it used to be, and last year is a one-third. They don't lower the corporate bills that they send me to keep up with this idiot game of theirs. And when it comes to oil independency, build them all. Build the nukes, peaker plants for small town. Boy, there's a good one. Use that natural gas up. Put the solar panels on the houses. Get the program going. You know, there's people out there, 6 to 8 million people that want to go to work, but these idiots can't figure out what the problem is.
Well, you know, to me it seems like, John, that the problem is a matter of priorities. I mean, it seems as if our leadership in Washington, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party in particular, including the Republicans, of course. I mean, that's a foregone conclusion. But, you know, the Democrats and Obama are supposed to be for us, the people. But what I've been seeing since his election and the majority in the Democratic Congress, or now it's only in the Senate, but nevertheless, we have, I mean, the priorities seem to be geared only towards the wealthy in general and the banking industry in particular. And the average worker out there is the one getting shafted. Energy independence, I mean, this is this year, of course, you're going to be hearing a lot of media hype this year about Ronald Reagan, because this is, if he was alive, he'd be celebrating his 100th birthday this year. And this actually, all this stuff started, began under Ronald Reagan, is his whole reorganization of this society towards the wealthy at our expense, the working people. And, you know, these policies have just been continuing expanding. The Reagan policies have been continuing expanding under both Democrat Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, as well as, of course, the Republican administrations since then.
Yeah, all the trillions of dollars of the stimulus that never got down to the working class of this country. The banks are using that money to play the stock market to get even richer. And I'll tell you what, between the trillions of dollars that the corporates are sitting on, the billionaires of this country, and the banks never lost any money. They made tons of money on building this country, the houses and the buildings. Interest rates. They made money when they shorted them stocks, knowing that in 97, Clinton, that gal Bourne, told them that it was crooked. And then they've shorted the stocks, they've longed the stocks, and they're still playing the market up. They're talking it could crash just like it did in 87, that they run it up so fast, so hard, that it looks like it's another setup for the grand finale of financial crash.
Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air. Okay, well, I guess the caller didn't get through, but yes, you're absolutely right, John. And, you know, talking about infrastructure, this country's in desperate need of infrastructure upgrade and expansion. I mean, it's not just the roads and bridges and sewers that are falling apart in this country. Our information, telecommunications infrastructure needs to be upgraded. You know, I found out from a guy I know who lives in China, you know how much he pays for high-quality, high-speed internet a year in China? You're not going to believe this. $40 a year. $40 a year. And here it costs, I think, about the cheapest I've ever found for high-speed internet is $25 a month if you get a bundle package with, say, AT&T. But anyway, there's also all the, I mean, this country could use a high-speed rail project and local town interurban rail projects to, you know, that could be, that needs to be done. I mean, Europe is light years ahead of this, you know, ahead of us on this. There's so much infrastructure that needs to be done, not to mention all the windmills and solar panels that need to be installed and all the research and development that the government needs to focus on instead of having these overseas wars of corporate aggression.
China is too far ahead as far especially with high-speed travel. And you mentioned this, especially with the internet, and that is absolutely one of the biggest things that's fallen out. There was something that Obama stumped on and talked about building up as a core element of the economy, was talking about high-speed telecommunications, but especially internet as infrastructure. And the amount of economic development, the improvement in communications that people could have. I mean, in so many places, you have... In Philadelphia is just one example. You have Wi-Fi in key areas. It's free throughout in places of the city, and this is not uncommon in so many places. There's no good reason not to have readily available, broad-based, and highly inexpensive, if not free, high-speed internet, for goodness sakes. And what high-speed internet we have is painfully slower than almost every other industrialized country.
That's true. I mean, I couldn't believe cell phones is another good example. My wife's friends from Germany came to visit here back in 2004, and they could use their cell phones. Their cell phones worked fine. They were texting their sons in Germany and stuff. And so, I mean, you know, here we can't. I mean, it's very difficult for us to do that here. I mean, you got to basically buy a European phone plan when you get to Europe if you want to use a cell phone. Try it again. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. You know, I want to, if I, the listeners in there who want to call in, please don't call in the rest of the show today, because we seem to be having a problem with the board here. I can't get the microphone, telephone light to go on. It's kind of flickering here. So we really enjoy hearing from you and stuff on the phones, but unfortunately, it's just not working out technically today. So hopefully next program we can do this again. Okay, yes, and John, so you had some more information on this article?
Yeah, I'm still 814 billion. That's got to be 814 million.
For what?
For the construction spending last year.
Just in the whole country or the state of Illinois?
Well, I'm talking a misprint here on the paper. But when it comes to the infrastructure problem, the one that worries me is the power grid. Mm-hmm. That thing shuts down and shuts down hard worldwide. It'll take over 10 years to get it fixed. How many people are going to freeze to death? How many is going to have heat strokes in the summer? Once that power is shut off, those computers are shut down.
Yeah, I mean, that would be interesting if that ever happened. I mean, it would be interesting in a bad way, of course. But anyway, Jason, do you have any more news stories today?
Let's see. I did have one more.
Mm-hmm.
This is from, actually, this morning's Washington Post, that... The Obama administration has decided to allow limited collective bargaining rights for transportation security officers. The decision by the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, marks an important, if not complete, victory for the two largest federal employee unions that have long pushed for the ability to negotiate on behalf of workers. Those unions, the American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Employees Union, are competing in an election campaign to win the support of about 45,000 officers who screen airline passengers and baggage. The election is being closely watched by the wider organized labor movement because the officers are the largest group of workers now engaged in a union organizing effort in the country. This decision excludes bargaining on any issue that the TSA considers security-related, including security procedures and the deployment of security personnel and equipment. Also excluded from bargaining are compensation, testing, job qualifications, and discipline standards. Republicans have long argued that airport screeners should not be allowed to unionize and bargain collectively. But Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, the top Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee, said the performance of other federal security officers who are unionized proves, quote, collective bargaining does not diminish our security. It can actually enhance workforce productivity and TSA's mission, end quote. Security officers had already been granted the right to vote for a union by the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Now they will vote with the certainty that the union that they choose will have the right to collectively negotiate for them. TSA also said that no union will be a choice as well. More than 13,000 transportation security officers are members of the unions, which until now could provide only personal representation.
Okay, we're going to listen to a little bit of Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back.
I recently came across three stories that ran in the New York Times on the same day, each in different sections of the paper, yet all tied together across class, politics, and time. In an editorial, the paper noted that after Wall Street crashed our economy, the Great Recession of 2008 caused another 1.7 million Americans to plummet into poverty. In 2009, though, even as joblessness soared, the poverty numbers did not rise. Why? Because President Obama's economic stimulus programs, including expanded unemployment benefits and an increase in food stamps, created a cushion that kept more people from dropping into poverty. Meanwhile, on the front page, the Times reported that a handful of Americans are not suffering at all from the recession, even though they helped cause it. They are the partners in Goldman Sachs, who are now reaping multi-million-dollar bonuses for their work last year, even though they performed poorly. Goldman's profits tumbled in 2010, and it had to pay a half-billion-dollar penalty for practicing investor fraud. Goldman also lobbied Congress to pass a very special law in December that dramatically reduces the taxes on those bonuses. By the way, this same law cuts weekly payments to the unemployed, a wicked move that'll push 175,000 more people into poverty this year. Then, on the obituary page, the Times covered the death of Sergeant Shriver. A lifetime idealist who worked tirelessly against poverty, Shriver helped create and run such pioneering efforts as the Peace Corps, Head Start, Job Corps, VISTA, and Legal Services back in the 1960s. This is Jim Hightower saying, how far we've come, huh? These three news stories jerk us from the time America's political leaders had the stuff to battle poverty to today, when our leaders battle the poor, even as they coddle the super rich. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street?
On the SP line, the strike sent out to fall. But Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and its drivers on the bum. And his engine and its bearings, they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line.
Casey Jones
a worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Then someone put a bunch of railroad ties across the track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
Casey Jones
hit the river bottom.
Casey Jones
broke his bloomin' spine.
Casey Jones
was an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line.
Casey Jones hit the river bottom. Casey Jones broke his bloomin' spine. Casey Jones was an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line.
When Casey Jones got up to heaven to the pearly gate, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that pulled the SP freight. You're just the man, said Peter, our musicians went on strike. You can get a job of scabbing anytime you like.
Casey Jones
got a job in heaven.
Casey Jones
was doing mighty fine.
Casey Jones
went scabbing on the angels just like he did to workers on the SP line.
Casey Jones got a job in heaven. Casey Jones was doing mighty fine. Casey Jones was grabbing on the angel just like he did to work it on the empty line.
The angels got together and they said it wasn't fair for Casey Jones to go around and scabbing everywhere. The angels union number 23, they sure were there, and they promptly fired Casey down the golden stair.
Casey Jones
went to hell a flying.
Casey Jones,
the devil said, oh fine.
Casey Jones,
get busy shoveling lumber, that's what you get for scabbing on the SP line.
Casey Jones went to hell a flying. Casey Jones, the devil said, oh fine. Casey Jones, get busy shoveling lumber, that's what you get for scabbing on the SP line.
Okay, welcome back. We are now entering that segment of the Labor Hour with some public service announcements. Today, I just wanted to announce Labor's Worldview TV on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, which is on this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. with hosts Jim Iman and David Johnson. Tune into Labor's Worldview TV to see the latest on historical and contemporary labor and social issues brought to you usually in a format of DVDs and general commentary and discussion with your hosts as well as an occasional guest. That's Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6. Okay, I wanted to go into a little segment here real quick about Black History Month. Today I'd like to just briefly mention a great labor, African-American labor leader named Ben Fletcher. Ben Fletcher was born in 1890, and he was in the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and he was a member of the Dock Workers Marine and Transport Union. And this man was quite an incredible individual. He basically went to work on the docks when he was a very young man, and the situation in Philadelphia at this time, basically from you know, the late 1890s up until 1913, when the IWW finally formed a union in the docks, was a situation to where you had three basic ethnic groups work in the docks. You had the traditional Irish, who had been here in this country since like the late 1840s. You also had African American dock workers who came to Philadelphia primarily right after the Civil War, and then you had the more newly arrived Slavic workers, mainly from Poland and Lithuania, who came during the 1890s. And the situation was the bosses of the docks pitted these three ethnic groups against each other. I mean, it went everything from they had all segregated gangs. In other words, the work gangs that unload and unload the ships were comprised either totally of African American, totally of Irish, or totally of Slavic people. And the bosses would pit them against each other. Basically, say, you know, hey you guys, you Irish, the blacks over there, they can load that ship a lot faster than you can. And then they tell the African Americans, hey you guys, these Polacks, these Slavics, they can load that ship even faster than you. And this worked quite a while because, unfortunately, this competition pitted these workers against each other, and there was a lot of hatred and occasional violence, too. But Ben Fletcher, African-American, was able, through his great oratory skills and personality, as well as his excellent organizing skills, was able to unite these three hostile ethnic groups to form the IWW. And, of course, one of their immediate demands was to desegregate the work gangs. And while the IWW was in control of the Philadelphia docks, I mean, working standards and pay improved significantly, and eventually it set the standards for the entire East Coast docks, whether they were unionized with the traditional ILA or even non-union docks. Anyway, I could go on and on about Ben Fletcher and the Marine Transport Workers Union, the IWW, but instead I'm going to refer you to a book called Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. It's by Professor Peter Cole, who's from Macomb, Illinois, Western Illinois University in Macomb, Illinois, and he was on the Labor Hour a couple years ago talking about his, at that time, newly published book. So this is an incredible story, and I highly recommend this book. So check out Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Area Philadelphia. And as the month of February moves on, we're going to be talking more about various African-American labor people. And Jason?
Yeah, that's it's a great story you bring up, and a great example of Black history, David and Fletcher. And I've not read Cole's book, unfortunately, but will definitely, especially on your suggestion. Fletcher was a great figure, and young during these times.
Yes, indeed.
Especially when he was organizing. He was in his 20s.
23 when he started, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what was one of the few prominent African-American leaders in the IWW, but there were others like Hubert Harrison. But definitely something to keep in mind, too, that he was young, he was African-American, and as David had said, was successful, and unfortunately jailed for some of his efforts, too.
Yes, indeed. And it's interesting, another great African-American labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, before he was a labor leader, had a newspaper, The Messenger, with Chandler Owen. And when Ben Fletcher was arrested, their newspaper made a cause celeb out of him. And so it's interesting how the two, I don't know if they've ever met, but they definitely, their paths, so to speak, did cross during this this time. And you got to understand, too, that organizing across racial lines during this period of time was extremely difficult for a lot of reasons. And this is what makes this story all the more remarkable, that these guys put aside all their ethnic hatreds and hostilities, and actually worked as a real union, a real brotherhood. So anyway, I'm going to play another track off this great collection of works, The Leftist Roots of the Folk Revival. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about another great working class hero, historian Howard Zinn.
Flying across the land and sea, everybody flying them but a Negro like me. Uncle Sam says, your place is on the ground. When I fly my airplanes, don't want no Negro round. The same thing for the Navy when ships go to sea. All they got is a mess boy's job for me, Uncle Sam says. Keep on your apron, son. You know I ain't gonna let you shoot my big Navy gun. Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow, Uncle Sam says. Two camps for black and white. But when trouble starts, we'll all be in that same big fight. I think democracy is fine. I mean democracy without the color line, Uncle Sam says. We'll live the American way. Let's get together and kill Jim Crow today. Shoulder is 6 foot tall, full more timber than a frame. hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll. Timber.
Okay, those two tracks you heard were from the 1930s by an artist named, an African-American artist named Josh White. The first song you heard was Uncle Sam Says about basically racial segregation in the military and in society in general. And this last song you just heard was Jerry the Mule, which is a great song, basically about a work gang hauling lumber, timber, and evidently Jerry the Mule had the most guts of all the men on that job site to actually strike back at the boss, literally. So some great music there, some great lyrics and stuff. So anyway, I guess today Jason had a great idea about timely too, since it's an anniversary of a to cover a very unique, extraordinary person. Jason?
Yeah, you know, when Dave and I were talking about show ideas, and David rightly recognized, I think there's a certain serendipity in talking about this in connection with Black History Month, was that it was, as Dave mentioned, January 27th, a year ago, that Howard Zinn had passed away. And it was just really very much a people's historian, as he had set out to be, writing so many different works as he did, but especially his people's history, most famously people's history of the United States, that really, especially when it came out, I think fit within this genre that started to become much more popular and prominent, of writing history, as it was called, from the bottom up. And people like Zinn meant it much less in terms of talking about everyday people on the bottom of society, although one can make a case that may be the case and what sort of weights are on us certainly these days. But he meant it more in terms of, for explanatory value, of talking about explaining forces and how change occurs from the bottom up, as far as getting to root causes and explanatory value with the widest possible coverage, and really talking about everyday people with a sense of prominence and of being central to the changes that occurred within their own lives. And had written this book, I think, is well worth reading, People's History, that did so much of that and did so much to revive an understanding and provide a deep understanding of things that I think have strong parallels for today. Talking about the robber barons of the 1880s, talking about this and really questioning this as a gilded age, with the idea of it being a golden era of American history, when, as Zinn provided so much in such detail then and afterwards, about what sort of suffering people had to undertake as American society had built so much and become so wealthy, and just also too, I think, did so much to locate culture and working class culture within his history. I think is really central so much to his work. And we will talk a bit more about it too, especially in talking about the early period of American development and Columbus, for which he received, I thought, a very unfair treatment, because he did some very good history on that. But I think it's hard to overestimate the impact that Howard Zinn had on the left during his life, and especially some of his most popular works in history.
Yes, and what I really love about Howard Zinn's work is that most of the history we're taught all the way from grade school, even into graduate school, is always from the perspective of the wealthy and the powerful, the military. You read about all the robber barons and the generals, and some inventors who, of course, later become wealthy. You never hear anything about all the inventions ordinary people made that were stolen from them and patented by various people who got credit for it. Great case in point is Eli Whitney's cotton gin. Was actually invented by a slave on his plantation.
Right.
Also, the Singer sewing machine was actually invented by a seamstress and was stolen by John Singer, who owned the tailor shop.
Another thing, Dave, is the same area of time, 1890s to 1920, Buckminster Fuller,
mm-hmm.
the book Grunts of Giants, which you can't get it in the Champaign Library or the Urbana Library. You got to go to Danville.
And that, you're kidding.
He ought to be taught in the schools.
I've never heard of that book.
Greatest,
what's it about?
Greatest humanitarian of our time.
Yeah. What's the book about?
The corporate, Bill was talking about a couple shows ago,
uh-huh.
on the corporations, overcharging the people. At that time, it was Standard Oil and the railroads to bring the oil in to heat the coal in to heat their houses. They were killing them.
What was the name of the book again?
Grudge of Giants.
Grudge of Giants.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's talking about the same thing you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Howard Zinn. You know, he took the perspective, of course, of people that usually voices are ignored in teaching American history: African Americans, American Indians, the organized labor, working people, immigrants, you know, and the women, of course, during the suffrage movement. What's interesting about his work, it goes all the way back in people's history of the United States, all the way back to British colonial times. We're talking pre-Revolutionary War. And what was interesting is that besides Africans who were brought here as slaves, there was also lots of indentured servants who were brought here from Europe, in particular from Ireland and Germany and Wales. And some of the earliest revolts on these plantations were actually interracial. It was the combination of both the European indentured servants and the African slaves. And this was what eventually led into all the segregation laws that are eventually put into the South.
Yeah, not to mention the American Indians as slaves before the Africans.
Yeah,
that's true. Yes, indeed. And you know, shortly after the founding of the early settlements in this country by the British, I mean Jamestown, whatever, had an immediate shortage of labor. And at that time, pre-colonial times, you actually had people had to carry around papers. And if you didn't look like a person of means, someone that's fairly wealthy, and they didn't know who you were in a particular town, the local constable or whatever would actually ask you to see your papers, that you had to prove, even if you were European, you had to prove that you weren't a runaway indentured servant. I mean, it's incredible how controlled the society was and everything. But, you know, Howard Zinn, in particular, was a very interesting person. I mean, he was from the working class. He was not from some well-off academic family. I mean, he was born on the Lower East Side into extreme poverty. When he became of age, he worked on the docks in New York City from the time he was 18 years old until he was 22, and during that time, even before, when he was just a young teenager, saw lots of demonstrations in New York City, police beating on demonstrators and everything else, and saw the labor movement actually at its height during the 30s. And, then when World War II came, he joined the military, was in the Air Force, fought in the European theater, was a bomber on a plane, and then after he got back from the war, him and his wife and eventually two children lived in public housing in New York City while he worked on getting his college degree and eventually his PhD. It took him 10 years to do it because he's also working to support the family as well as his wife. And finally, in 1956, he got his PhD, and the only job he could get was at an all-black college in the South, Spelman College, which I believe is in Albany, Georgia. It's right in the Atlanta, Georgia area. I know that.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And at that time, Jewish people, anyone of Jewish descent, had a hard time finding work as professors, only in certain areas. And black colleges were in desperate need at that time of any qualified professors. So he came there and was put in charge of the whole history department and everything. And there's some other interesting stories about after he gets to Spelman. I mean, he got there like 56, just a few years before all the civil rights movement really hit full force. And he that's the thing about Howard Zinn. He wasn't just some ivory tower academic. He was an activist. You know, he walked it like he talked it, and he got into the middle of things and encouraged his students to do what their conscience told him. And that's another interesting thing about Howard Zinn to me, was that it was reported that he always taught with a perspective that always came through as a moral outrage about the conditions, both historical and current.
Absolutely right. And that, he ended up losing his job at Spelman for his activism. And Spelman is actually, it's in Atlanta. He lost his job over civil rights activism, and he was someone, and David puts it well. And I've always thought the idea of the ivory tower with professors has always been a bit unfair. Yeah, and there are plenty of people like that, but there are an awful lot of people, I think, here in Champaign-Urbana community. I think plenty of people in the history department, I think, are good examples of people who live out their conscience and are very much involved in the community. And Zinn was exactly like that, especially as Dave is saying. I mean, he was someone who was involved with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in these campaigns, and these were dangerous campaigns. There was there was white right-wing terrorism that killed people and attacked people, you know, such as, you know, the Freedom Rides. You had people's lives more than just being disrupted. You had people like Bob Zellner, for example, who was a white SNCC activist, who had his eyeball torn out. I mean, you had people who were maimed, if not outright killed. And Zinn was at the forefront of this and involved as an activist. And I think, too, that he saw so many of these struggles, and he saw people as workers in the labor that they were involved in, going all the way back to the foundations of the Western presence in the Western Hemisphere, issues of wealth, of gold, being at the root of the expeditions of Columbus and those who followed him. It was putting the Arawaks, the Tainos, to work or killing them as the alternative, that really it was issues of work and profit being at the root of the formation of our society here in the Western Hemisphere.
It sounds like he figured out the authoritarians and the totalitarians.
Oh, indeed. I mean, well, he lived it. He experienced it as a child, you know. He mentions about how his father was not even literate, and he had to he worked you know, whenever he could, and they would move around a lot, you know. He says some years when his father did well, they lived in a 3-room apartment with central heating, and other years when he wasn't doing so well, they ended up having to move into a 2-room apartment with a coal stove in the kitchen. And this was a mother, a father, 2 adults, and him and his 3 brothers. There was a family of 6 people living in a 2-room apartment. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, absolutely unbelievable. But so he knew it firsthand. That's the thing. You know, he didn't read about it. He experienced it, you know.
Right. Including war. And that's the thing where it's easy for people to want to point the finger, especially for people on the right toward the left, of especially casting people as somehow weak for being anti-war. And I don't believe that anyway. I think it takes strength to stand up for these sorts of causes. And Zinn was there.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved in, and he had seen and inflicted the horrors of war. He knew what it was all about. He was not some distant critic of all this stuff.
He was in World War II in the European theater. What's interesting, too, is that when the Vietnam War came about, he was in the forefront of anti-war activism. In fact, him and Father Berrigan and I think it was Dave Derringer, I think his name
Dellinger?
Was? Dellinger, yes, Dellinger. Actually, were invited to North Vietnam to be basically, they were going to release, I think it was 3 U.S. Fighter pilots into their custody, you know, as a goodwill gesture to try to have some kind of peace talks. And so they flew there, got them released. They went to Laos. And, of course, the U.S. government they'd worked a deal out with completely reneged on their deal, confiscated the airmen, and basically, you know, took over the whole event and stuff. But it was interesting because Howard, when he got back, mentioned about how while he was in Hanoi, he actually experienced a U.S. bombing campaign on the receiving end. He mentions, he goes, I learned firsthand what it was like when I was flying in World War II. And he says it was pretty horrifying and quite a humbling experience. So, I mean, the man, you know, he definitely was no hypocrite, that's for sure.
No doubt. And I'd highly recommend for anyone who has not read it, reading A People's History. And it's not without some, that is, one could, I think, criticize it in some ways, in that what he does not do is explain why it is that so many of these movements where he's locating so much resistance, why it is that so many of these movements fail. He doesn't necessarily explore right-wing countervailing movements and some other aspects that would help explain why it is that so much of this resistance that he's locating fails. I also think in certain areas he gives the 30s some short shrift. You know, he really glosses over some of these things, but he does so much within this book, and especially in locating in, say, the so-called Gilded Age, so much activism and tying together these different groups, not unlike the way David did, I think, with Peter Cole's book, that he sees people's causes as oftentimes being interconnected in ways that is extremely valuable and worth remembering.
Yes, and in fact, that would make a good historical research project, Jason, as far as just what you mentioned about why a lot of these movements failed, because there were a lot of them that a lot of people aren't aware of until you dig into the history. You know, for every one that was successful, there probably had to be at least a half a dozen that, you know, that failed ultimately. John, I mean, you might be aware of this. I wasn't aware of this until our mutual friend. There's a good, I think, a good parallel as a local example of a Howard Zim is our mutual friend, Jim Barrett.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I hope he doesn't mind me mentioning his name, but I just had to mention that. Enlightened me on a movement in the labor movement during the 1920s in the construction industry, in particular the carpenters, called the I started this subject and I can't remember the name of the organization, but basically it was a dissident construction workers movement within the labor movement, within the unionized labor movement, and it was the I can't remember the name of it right now. I'll think about it as soon as we get off the show, but it was really fascinating was that they had quite a movement. I mean, it was very progressive, and they were just crushed by the official union leadership, in particular the Carpenters Union, Big Bill Hutchinson. They had all these delegates. They had almost half the delegates at the National Carpenters Convention. I think it was in 1927. And Hutchinson got on the floor, and because